Ideally, you are gaining like the psychological experience of watching your investments go up and down, and you're developing the habit of seeing your money go out every single month, saving first before you spend. That's huge. And the sooner you do that, the better. Like, I don't, it's just, there's no argument there, I don't think.
Yeah, you might not be impressed when you look up 1 year later, but you look up 5 years later and you're like, wow, that's a big difference. But you can't get there if you don't start in the first place.
Welcome to Finance for Physicians, the show where we help physicians like you use money as a tool to live a great life. I'm your host, Daniel Wren, and I've spent the last decade advising physicians on their personal finances with the mission to help them understand that taking control of their finances now means creating a future where they can practice medicine where, when, and how long they want to.
Hugh, how's it going?
Great, Daniel. How are you?
I'm good. You've been coaching a lot of baseball. I see your background picture, which I've already seen that picture, but that's a solid baseball coach and son picture right there.
Yeah, it's a bittersweet time of the year. Last game will be Monday. We just had a parents versus kids game last night, so that was a lot of fun.
You whoop up on them?
We thought about it. We're like, oh, we're gonna, you know, let them get on and score, and then we're like, maybe the last inning we'll show them we still got it. But
well, eventually, yeah, that goes away where they start really legitimately beating you.
Yeah, but it's 6 years old.
Yeah, right. And you got a few more years before that happened.
Right.
Cool. Well, apparently this is our 200th episode, so kind of a big one. I didn't realize Teresa, who helps us produce the shows, informed me that it was the big 200th. So we're going to be talking today on our 200th episode about some of the most common mistakes that we see, particularly with residents transitioning or fellows transitioning into practice. And really, I think this could apply to anyone seeing like a large income increase, because I think that's the biggest factor at play. But also, you know, throw in the potential move, new job, probably, you know, new everything, new friends, new location, new schools, new everything. It makes it a particularly challenging transition point. And I think it's like probably one of the most mistake prone times of your life. Would you agree with that, you?
Yeah, for sure. Anytime you're about to have big changes, lots of emotions, you're making big decisions, always a good time to try to be proactive and think big picture, take your time with your decisions.
Yeah, I think too, there's some like, I haven't lived it. Hugh's actually lived this transition, so I'm curious what you think, Hugh, but it seems like there's a lot of times this pent up, I don't know what to call it, pent up spending, living like a resident for so long and working so hard for, you know, not getting paid market wages. So there's like this pent up, like, you know, I need to be compensated well and also enjoy my money. And so that seems to sometimes amplify it all where it's like, it's time to live, you know, spend or live. Or sometimes people take that it's time to save everything too, but it's like this pent up, like I got to catch up on life.
Yeah, it was about, well, I should say 2018, I think, is when my wife graduated from residency. And yeah, I think our main thoughts at that time were wanting to enjoy the fruits of her labor, but also not blow it either.
Right. Strike a good balance.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I know y'all have done a good job with that. I'm sure not perfect, but from the outside, it seems like y'all have done a really good job with that. So yeah, let's jump into some of those big mistakes. You want to throw out the first one here that we commonly see?
Well, I think the first thing whenever you're making this big change, taking a new job, is just always making sure that you understand your contract, right? Always good to hire a contract attorney to review that with you, just to make sure that you understand everything that's in there. That's kind of number one, but also, you know, they'll know the market for your specialty, what people are paid in your position, especially for things like comparing RVU targets, which I would say I would pay more attention to the RVU target than necessarily whatever schedule they say you can work. So I think those are important things. Not getting used to that guaranteed salary, maybe.
Yes.
Is a good thing. Like, let's understand where you're going to be at production wise and if that guaranteed salary is ultimately realistic. And then another thing that we were intentional with, and with the people that we work with, we try to be intentional with as well, is anytime someone's getting a signing bonus in this contract where it's not necessarily yours yet until you fulfill that contract. You know, I know we were talking earlier about this pent up spending demand. You might want to buy your first home. You might want to replace your beater car, which you won't get any sympathy from Daniel for. You might get a little sympathy from me on that one, but don't go out and spend that signing bonus until it's actually yours. So maybe set that aside in a separate account just in case something happens. You don't fulfill that contract, you need to pay it back. That's a good thing to understand, and just how that vests over time, which vesting just means, you know, how you earn that over time. The amount of time that you stay and continue working with them. But I mean, really, before we even talk about how to spend the money, let's just understand the contract and what you have to do to get the money.
Yeah. And you mentioned, I think probably the most important point is like hiring and paying a third party expert is extremely valuable, especially for this decision. Even if you have like a physician friend, old, you know, mentor type that like reviews your contract and knows what they're talking about and gives you advice, even if you have a lot of knowledge or a business degree or whatever, I think it's super valuable to hire like a unrelated third party that you're paying money to give you advice on around the contract. Because what they do essentially, I mean, at the end of the day, like you was saying, they help you to have a more thorough understanding. It's almost impossible to understand it from all the different views because it's complicated. So you got to look at it from the view of the hospital or whoever, the private practice, or, you know, competitive market, legal view, from the physician's view, or there's all these different views and there's legal language and it's very complicated. And so I think a lot of people think they understand their contract, and they maybe do understand components, but ideally you want to get the maximum possible understanding. And I think really without spending a ton of time, the only way to do that is to hire some sort of expert that like that's their job and they do it all the time. And I think that's a super valuable use of money. And I think a lot of people don't do that. Sometimes it costs you big time, especially in some of the things particularly I would look out for is especially for like long duration, long-term locked in, big sign-on bonus, big time strings attached contracts. You have to be super careful with those because you can end up getting in a dicey situation where, you know, you can't get out. It's like you got to wait 5 years or pay back a big bonus, or there's lots of different pinches you can get into with these contracts.
Right. Lots of different things. I mean, just think if there's somebody that has reviewed hundreds of these in their lifetime, you know, odds are they are going to have, you know, some sort of insight there that you don't have, even though, you know, it's very tough to get into med school, right? You're obviously very smart people. You just don't have the experience looking at some of these things, and they'll know where employers are willing to maybe bend a little bit. They've seen that before. Think if you're putting an offer in on a house, you're probably not going to come in with your best offer right off the bat. So maybe it's not a huge salary increase that you get, but maybe it's something like in the contract where, you know, they can move you to a different office, but maybe you get into your contract like, I'm working at this specific location because maybe you're thinking about buying a house around that. Actually, it's actually something contract attorney was able to get worked into my wife's contract. So her office is 2 miles from where we live. So that was huge. So even things like that can be huge peace of mind.
Yep. Awesome. Well, that's a good segue. You mentioned your house, which is also a common mistake, the home decision.
Right. And a lot of people, this is when you're graduating or you're moving, getting a new contract, you're going to buy a house. Maybe it's buying your first house. And I certainly understand wanting to, you know, finally become a homeowner. That's like the American dream, right? I think where a lot of people go wrong is that becomes all of a sudden the most important thing for you to spend all of your hard-earned money on, when maybe 2 years ago you cared more about experiences, or you have other hobbies. You're like, man, when I'm not working 80 hours a week, I want to take up surfing or, you know, some other hobby. And maybe now you have the opportunity to do that. But if you get yourself locked into too high of expenses, right? I think a significant amount of people that we work with in the first 3 to 5 years, they're talking about reducing their FTE. Significant amount.
Very large.
So that's, a home is such a fixed expense. You can't just decide to not go to Europe, you know, this year. It's locked in. Now you could move, but it's extremely hard to downgrade your home. Very easy to upgrade.
Yes. And the home thing, a lot of people talk about rules of thumb. They're like, oh, as long as I'm spending under 2 times or 3 times my income, or I don't know, there's a few rules of thumb. And then the lenders and the real estate agents will give you rules of thumb, and they'll make you feel good about it. Like that you're making, you go to the lender, they're like, yeah, you know what? You can afford 3 million, but let's go for 1.5. And that's super reasonable. But what really the true answer is, it's very personalized to your situation, and you can't look at the house just like independently. A lot of times we put blinders on with these kinds of emotional decisions, and then we like just zero in and focus on the house only, and it becomes the only thing. So what you really have to do, like you were saying, is think about all the other things that are important in life, like work less versus work more, hobbies, other, you know, spending, experiences, on spending on vacations, education, saving for retirement, like anything else you could do with your time and your money is kind of, you know, up for consideration and potentially in conflict with what you spend on your house. So you got to think about it more from a, I think it's healthier to think about it from a, you know, trade-offs viewpoint, because no doubt the more you spend on your house, the less you have for other things. Or the less time you have available because you have to work more to pay for the thing.
Right. I don't think I've ever had a lender ask me, how many kids do you have? Right. That's yeah. That's not factored into how much you can afford monthly in a house. Right. Kids can be expensive, especially if you're or low income family. Who's watching the kids? Right.
Or how much are you saving for retirement? Or do you all travel much? Are you hitting your travel goal? Do you love your job? Do you hate your job? Is the reason you hate your job because you're working too much? Are you burning out? Are you not burning out? Are you a part-time? Are you full-time? If you're part-time, that's a totally different situation than if you're working 80 hours a week. You got to remember, if you're working 80 hours a week, you're basically 120% of capacity. Like, you can't earn any more than that. And you're probably going to, you know, burn out at some point working that many hours.
Right. So maybe the actionable advice there is think long and hard about the other stuff that's more important than the house before you start to work on your house budget. And then also maybe think about the things that you can't change over time with the house, right? So maybe you can't change the location or the school district. So maybe focus on that. And yeah, maybe you don't have a kitchen that looks like it's on Pinterest, but those are things that can be changed over time, right? And then odds are you might get used to it and not care after a while, or you're like, well, the kids are going to destroy it anyway, so I'll wait till they're older.
Right. Yeah. Or you just don't know, too. You could end up, another thing, like we've have a lot of clients that don't like their first job. Go figure. It's like brand new everything. Yeah. And so a lot of times it doesn't work out, or, you know, they hate it sometimes. So that's not exact. None of them. What's funny is everybody's like, yeah, you know, I really like this job. I feel like we're going to be set here for a long time. Nobody ever's like, it's probably going to suck and it's not going to work out. Like no one ever says that. So, but it's better to, I think for those huge decisions like that, to kind of think about that potential scenario of how does it work with this big, huge purchase I'm about to make in the situation where the job doesn't work out and I'm trying to get out of here just 3 months in.
Yeah. There's a psychological factor there too. Like you buy the house, you don't want to admit that like, oh, I kind of want to move now. You might just act like everything's okay. Keep going to work. Keep trying to make it work. You're miserable. That's an impact too. But
yes, it kind of compounds on the whole denial of maybe underlying issues. So,
right.
Hey guys, quick break here to let you know about a new project we've been working on that we're really excited about. We've created a self-paced course just for physicians making the transition from training into practice. It's called Vitals Check, Your Money Game Plan for Post-Residency Life. This course is not designed to turn you into a financial professional. Instead, it's about helping you become an expert in your personal finance so you can make confident decisions about things like housing, student loans, investing, and more. We've made it super practical and interactive with short video lessons, a digital workbook, and tracking tools to help you actually do something with the information. And you'll be learning from the same great financial planners who've joined me here on the podcast, Jackie, Heather, Jen, Jeff, and Hugh, sharing their real-world knowledge on the topics they care most about. The course launches next month, but you can join the waitlist now at courses.financeforphysicians.co. We'll also make sure to include that link in the show notes so it's easy to find. So the next one kind of can go, I think, in tangent with the house.
Yeah, I think the other thing too that is just not leaving enough room in your budget or cash flow for surprises that come along. Maybe it's more children than you planned on, or maybe it's you thought you wanted to work full time, but maybe it's getting overwhelming and you want to drop down to 0.9 or 0.8 or something like that. And, you know, 10% of the types of income for our audience is not nothing, right? That's like a nice chunk of money. So, you know, not leaving enough room for surprises and just not having that flexibility to make changes that maybe you otherwise would have wanted to. That's another thing that tends to come up and really, like you said, goes hand in hand with the house purchase a lot of times.
Yeah, that's a huge one. I've made that mistake myself like 15 different times, especially earlier in my career. And I've seen it a ton. Pretty much everyone tends to gravitate towards this view of like, okay, I'm going to make $10,000 whatever dollars a month. And so let's go ahead and plan for where all the $10,000 goes. And so let's make, you know, we'll buy the house, we'll do the living expenses, whatever, maybe save some for retirement, the budget. If they're, you know, if they're doing a good job, even that's a great exercise. But I've seen the budget, I've done it myself a zillion times. And you typically with the budget, you think, okay, let's account for every dollar. And so then you start doing it and you're like, why are we over every month? Because you're always over every month because there's unexpected things. So it's like a perfection. I think it's a perfectionist thing. Maybe it's like you want to do the perfect budget. Some people just don't budget at all. So don't do that. But like if you're budgeting, a lot of times we do this perfectionist budget, and the perfectionist budget I always say is like you try to account for every dollar, and a budget can't be perfect. So you end up setting this perfect expectation and you always are let down and you're always over budget. And you're like, I'm failing and I don't even want to do it at all. And so I never, you know, you never budget again. So just this simple little point we're making of like building in some margin, 10%, that's great. Where it's just like, let's just have 10% that's not accounted for and is going to be surplus that we, you know, Maybe you set aside for a rainy day. Maybe you put it in an investment account and do nothing with it, and it has no purpose. That goes a long way, like huge. And it ends up being 7% because you just, the things that you don't expect. And then you're like, wow, I'm under budget. This is great. It's just a different mentality to be under as opposed to blowing your budget every month.
Yeah. I think it's kind of like your downside with that scenario is you're driving a Honda Pilot when you could be driving a Suburban, and your upside is like the mentality of, if this administrator who has no idea what goes on in a patient room bothers me about my RVUs again, I'm going to give him my 90-day notice on the spot.
I'm out.
That is a huge peace of mind to have, to know that you have that wiggle room. You have options.
Yes. So it's good. I would say, big mistake, not leaving enough for surprises or building in margin. And I think the takeaway, ideally, I would encourage people to build in as much margin as they can tolerate, I think. Because it's not like no one ever gets bent out of shape about having, you can always decide to spend it later after you've now seen this margin or this surplus in your budget play out. After a few months, you're like, wow, we're saving half our income. Now you can always be like, well, let's start intentionally spending some of it. But that margin
is... Right. Like you could do discretionary expenses, like bigger bucket list type trips. You know, that's not something that you must go on every year, right? That's something you could cut out if you needed to, once you got a healthy reserve built up.
Yep. And this kind of, I mean, this kind of goes against, like, I think some of the gurus, like Dave Ramsey, and they say like, but account for every dollar. And what we're kind of telling you is like, I mean, I guess they talk about rainy day funds, but what we're saying is like, set aside money for like no particular purpose.
Exactly.
And it's more about cash flow. This is more about a cash flow part of not being so reliant on your income.
Yeah. It's saving for the things that you know that you don't know, like things are going to inevitably happen and there's no way that you're going to plan for it. Or even if you sat down for 2 hours and tried to think of every little thing, like, oh, well, eventually my car is going to need tires, or like, you know, there's just a million things that, they happen. You're like, oh yeah, these things come up, but you're not thinking about it when you're trying to do the math and account for every dollar with bigger home purchase, car purchase, that kind of stuff.
Yep. All right. Next mistake. This is a fun, this is a not fun one, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of goes along with maybe not planning for the unexpected, but you know, being underinsured or maybe even inappropriately insured. So maybe that's not having disability insurance. When your income goes up, you're just riding with the policy that the employer provides, or maybe failing to lock in insurance while you're still in training. So not only is there usually some type of discount for getting it when you're in training before you graduate, sometimes there's a window afterwards, but specific policies called guaranteed standard issue policies. So those are policies where you wouldn't guaranteed to get a policy. There are some other check boxes there, but you know, for some people that might otherwise not be able to get insurance, I think. I'm thinking of other people where this has come up. Maybe type 1 diabetes is one of those areas, something like that, where you might have a little trouble getting insurance. But if you get them through these guaranteed programs, you can get insurance. But it's important to work with a professional in this area, because there are other instances where you might apply for insurance somewhere else, you get denied, and now because you have a denial on your record, you can't get the guaranteed policy. So good independent insurance agent can help you out there.
Yeah, the main thing is, or you know, getting it in place early and when you're healthy and in training, ideally you get disability insurance for sure. And I think life insurance is the other biggie insurance you got to think about getting, especially when you have kids, like, or even when you're expecting, that's like a big deal to knock that out. And a lot of times we come across people that, and I get it, like, you don't, that's like a very low likelihood situation. It's like, that's not going to happen. And it probably is not going to happen. But, and The problem is for you, law of large numbers, you get 100,000 people, it's going to happen to like five of them. So it's got a low probability. The problem is you don't know which one of those 100,000 people you are. You could be the five and you just don't know what's going to happen in the future. The other good thing about the low probability stuff like that is that's the only reason it's affordable. Like it wouldn't be affordable if it was a high probability, like the insurance wouldn't. So it's nice that it's such a low probability. That's why term life insurance is so inexpensive for young, healthy people, is because it's a very low likelihood. But yeah, you never know.
Yeah, that's right. Same thing, maybe even if you don't have kids, but buying a home, right? Taking out debt together. Mm-hmm. That's another good reason to make sure that you are insured.
What's next on the list? Investing. This is a good one.
Yeah, I'd say waiting too long to start investing. We'll have some people that come to us and maybe they're a year out of graduation or whatever, and they've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars sitting in a savings account, which that is a wonderful problem to have. That's actually the difficult part, is saving the money. Maybe you can stay in the same apartment after graduating, dual physician family. But, you know, you might look back and be like, well, it's sitting in a savings account that got 1%, or you didn't even move it to one where it's a high yield savings account, or maybe the market did 15% or something like that. And all of a sudden that, you know, one or $200,000 could have been like a Honda Civic, you know, amount of money that you left on the table if you'd just started to put the money to work a little bit more often. I think, I'm curious to know what you think on this, Daniel, but I think part of that problem is just kind of analysis paralysis. You start to dive in, what should we do with the money? You don't come to a conclusion, and then you don't think about it again for a month, and then you just repeat the same process. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that seems like that would make sense. I also could see it just being mixed with like, you're just busy. So it's like, you got to kind of take a lot of people, me included, especially like the younger I was, I wanted to like figure it out, kind of like figure the thing out before I did it to some extent. And so I knew I needed to do the research or whatever and take the time to figure the thing out. And so, you know, that's where the analysis paralysis comes in. But it, in combination with not having a lot of spare time, is especially difficult, because it's like, I know I need to analyze it, and I've started to kind of analyze it, and but I don't have a lot of time, so I'm kind of like spinning my wheels on it, and so it's difficult, and it's a complicated thing, or it feels complicated on the front end, especially when you don't have experience. So that's when that's why you should hire a financial planner, really. I mean, we're financial planners, so we're biased, but that is one of the benefits of working with a financial planner, is like shortcutting that whole like decision-making process.
Yeah, people don't hire us because they're not necessarily smart enough. It's just because they don't have the time to spend learning the thing, or they're hiring us because, if they're being honest, it's just not going to happen. They're just not going to do the thing. There are things, lots of different things that people hire out for that. Could be like lawn maintenance, right? You just don't have the time, and that's just not what you want to spend your Saturday morning doing. Maybe it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like checking your blood work or whatever, like in medical world, like nobody, I don't know a lot of physicians that like regularly check their blood work on their own. They kind of have to go to their own primary care person. They're like, yeah, we probably ought to get your labs. And they're like, yeah, I know I got to do that, but I haven't done, because I just, life's busy and I don't really want to look at all that stuff. But it's one of those things, you know, you need to do it, but it's very easy to procrastinate.
Yeah. I think the other thing too, there is this fear of like, well, what if whatever I invest in goes down?
Yeah. There's
right. And so you have like incentives, like, well, I'm going to worry about what my spouse thinks, you know, he or she is going to maybe blame me, or, you know, you're going to feel shame. And, you know, if you're hiring someone who's an expert in these things, right, then you don't have that on your plate of responsibilities anymore. You're going to have a lot less stress, let alone saving the time. And then let he or she, the expert, explain, you know, why the investments are down, and maybe it makes sense, right? maybe you come to the conclusion, let's deposit more money while it's down. But I think that's another key component that often gets
overlooked. Having the third party, yeah, is when you're, especially when you're married, is very valuable. And then there's just the experience, like the experience of watching or seeing your investments go up and down, the experience of like watching the money come out of your account every month, like the habit of those things. Those are pretty important things that you kind of overlook and you don't realize how important they are. There's like, of course, like the rate of return and the numbers part, but like the habit part of it is what I'm talking about. And the psychology part of it, ideally you are gaining like the psychological experience of watching your investments go up and down, and you're developing the habit of seeing your money go out every single month, saving first before you spend. That's huge. And the sooner you do that, the better. Like, I don't, it's just, there's no argument there, I don't think.
Yeah. You might not be impressed when you look up 1 year later, but you look up 5 years later and you're like, wow, that's a big difference. But you can't get there if you don't start in the first place.
Yep. Got to start soon. All right. Well, we're getting close to time. Maybe we can throw out one more here mistake. Which one do we want to do? We got a long list. So.
Oh yeah.
I don't know.
Well, since not everybody has student loans, and I'll defer to podcasts with Jeff on student loans, I'll say chaotic taxes, especially around the graduation period. Common things that come up are maybe you're used to contributing to a Roth IRA while you're in residency, and then you graduate, you make more money. Now you're over the income limit to contribute directly to a Roth IRA. So you go to file your taxes. You get that notice that says you made too much. You have to correct it. You're like, oh, geez, I don't have time to figure this out. What's the process? What do I got? I got to call somebody. I got to sit on an 800 phone number, you know, to get this corrected. That's common. We see that a lot. Maybe now your income's a 1099. Maybe you took some position like that. You have to make estimated tax payments now. Please don't wait and file and then just pay it all at once. Plus the penalty, especially now with interest rates are higher. So is the penalty for not paying your taxes on time. That's another reason to hire a professional, you know, at least a CPA in that situation. There are other things you could get into with that, but we're not going to get into that today. Over-contributing to retirement plans is another common one too. If you are changing jobs in mid-year because your new employer has no idea what you contributed to your last employer, so you could end up doing another similar thing with the Roth IRA there, where you have to call in somewhere, get the money taken out. Now you've got a new tax document for that excess contribution coming on maybe the next year. And it's just a mess and a headache and not how you want to spend an hour or two.
Yeah. The other one is, I think of as bonuses. Like if, when you get paid big bonuses or any bonus, like a sign-on bonus, especially what I'm thinking about, they can be, they're all over the place tax-wise. Sometimes they're taxed all at once. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're spread out. Sometimes they're taxed on the back end. So like, you got to understand how that is going to work. Because, I mean, we would typically advocate like, pretend like it's not yours if there's some sort of like catch to it. Like typically those bonuses are like, you got to work 5 years to truly earn it. So if that's the case, pretend it's not really your money until you've earned it over the five-year period. So, but you also have to understand, especially if you're going to start spending it, what the tax implications are of the bonus. Like, when are you going to pay the tax? And not wait until, you know, April 15th of the year that we're talking about to figure out what the tax implications are. Ideally, you know, as soon as you're getting the bonus. And ideally, you're not like depending on the hospital or something to tell you what the tax implications are. You want to get like somebody that works for you or it's looking out for you to kind of help you figure that out.
Yeah. I've had one case where rough numbers, let's say you got a $20,000 signing bonus and annual salary is 360, right? So you're getting paid 30 grand a month and they didn't tell them we're going to take the taxes out for that in your first paycheck. So you're expecting a 30 grand free tax and it says 10 grand. And, you know, you can imagine you're having like a heart palpitations.
Like, dang, they take not taxes.
Yeah. When your direct deposit's significantly lower than you thought. And
yeah,
then you're trying to figure that out. And again, you're wasting 20 minutes right. trying to figure this out and all the anxiety that goes along with that.
Yeah. I mean, just the fact of knowing or projecting, getting an idea of what your taxes are going to be before you start earning the money is helpful. Like a lot of, I think a big mistake is making a lot of big financial decisions before you even know what your tax implications are going to be. So like when you get the $400,000 salary, for example, you got to understand how much of that you're actually going to take home, which includes figuring out what the tax component is going to be. And then sometimes people don't, maybe they underestimate that amount, and that's a huge problem.
That's right.
Awesome. Well, Hugh, on the 200th episode, we have had fun as always, and I appreciate you coming on to talk about some mistakes. Hopefully you guys listening avoid all of these. Hopefully you're rocking it out, but in reality, we all are having, I mean, I've experienced many of these mistakes myself. So if we're, or as we're experiencing them, hopefully we're learning from them to avoid them in the future.
Yep. That's the key takeaway.
Learn. I always say failing forward. So as long as we're failing forward, that's the key.
Yep. Well, thanks for having me.
No guests or clients appearing on the podcast received any form of compensation for their appearance and obtained no other benefit from us. It should not be assumed that every client has had the same experience.